From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Peter Dutton is the government's hard man, formerly the Home Affairs Minister and now Defence Minister. He is the most assertive senior voice in the coalition on the threat of China and on national security issues in general. In the election campaign, he will be seeking to force Labor onto the back foot on national security. Not an easy task when Anthony Albanese has been determinedly bipartisan in this area. Dutton has never hidden his leadership ambitions. In 2018, he made his bid against Malcolm Turnbull, which, however, backfired, ending in the elevation of Scott Morrison. If the coalition loses the coming election, Peter Dutton would likely face off against Josh Frydenberg for leader of the opposition. Peter Dutton joins us today. Let's start with Ukraine. What should be done now by Western countries? And do you stick by your description of President Putin as an ageing dictator who is more and more irrational?
Michelle, the West needs to speak with one and in a very tightly united voice. We need to make sure that we can provide whatever deterrence possible, because nobody wants to see the bloodshed in the Ukraine that is inevitable if Russia crosses the border and a conflict potentially protracted continues on, and the human life and the suffering would be significant. So it's in everyone's interests to provide whatever deterrence possible and to stop Ukraine from becoming the next conflict point. And I think that's the way in which we should all approach it.
And Putin?
Well, in relation to Putin, I mean, again, people only need to look at his track record and concerning human rights abuses in Russia. There's no sense, when we're dealing with a bully of any nature, believing that if we just close our ears and our mouth, that somehow the bully will become a good person or that they won't be deterred from their next act. And I've been of a view and remain of that view that we're better off to be very frank in our assessments and our advice and call out behaviour which is unacceptable. And I made the comments in relation to President Putin. Stand by those comments, and I hope that President Putin can change his ways. But the election process within Russia, the human rights abuses, many other egregious acts would cause concern for any reasonable observer. And I don't think my comments are extraordinary in that context.
Now, turning to China, what do you say to the criticism that you've been more belligerent in your language than necessary, given the economic stakes involved?
I'm just not sure who's making that that claim. From my perspective, again, we have the militarisation of the South China Sea, the near military conflict within the East China Sea between China and Japan. Indian troops have been killed on the land border between China and India, even in recent months. China is in dispute with the Philippines. They're in dispute with Vietnam. They're in dispute with Indonesia. They're in dispute with other countries in the region. The attacks on Lithuania have been quite pronounced and continue unabated. So this problem with the relationship between China and Australia is not of Australia's making. Australia is a good friend. We're a reliable friend. We're a good partner. We adhere to our values. And I'm not going to deviate from that. But I do believe that China is on a pathway of aggression, particularly toward Taiwan. And I want to be part of what I think is a majority view around the world to stop that from taking place. I want China to continue to grow economically. I want to see people lifted out of poverty. But I don't want to see a clash, particularly between great powers. And I think, again, we're better off to be frank in our assessments and to argue from a position of strength, not weakness, because otherwise we will find ourselves in conflict in the Indo-Pacific, and that's not what anybody wants.
If Taiwan came under attack from China, would Australia feel obliged to come to its defence?
Well, I think there are a lot of steps to consider before that point. And I think every action we take, certainly from my perspective, every action I take is to make sure that we don't have conflict in our region. I don't want to see the Indo-Pacific return to conflict. And really now the ball is in the court of China. And China has stated very clearly their intentions in relation to Taiwan. There are a lot of observers in this space who say, well, the actions wouldn't be restricted to Taiwan. There would be an impact on other countries in the region, not that China would be an occupying force, but that they would seek to exert control through trading relationships or economic coercion or other means. That would change the Indo-Pacific very significantly. So people need to ask themselves two questions, not just the obvious first one of what conflict would mean in our region, but the second important question is what would a conflict mean where there was a next step or a step beyond that, and what would the impact be on our trading relationship at that point? So it's a question of not only action, but what results, what consequences flow from inaction. And these are difficult discussions, difficult questions, and everybody would, you know, prefer not to be having them. But China puts us in this position. They're putting many other countries in the position as well. It's why NATO has exercised about the Indo-Pacific. It's why the Germans have recently sent a frigate here as well as the Brits. And it's why many others within the European Union are very concerned about the actions of China.
You've recently had a review done of the Port of Darwin, on which Chinese company has a 99-year lease. When are you going to announce a decision on the future of that lease? And isn't it entirely illogical to be as concerned about China as Australia and especially the government are, and yet have the Chinese with a lease on this port?
Well, Michelle, I mean, there are a number of considerations, some of them classified in relation to the Darwin port. There was a report commissioned by the National Security Committee, and the committee is considering that report and the response. And in terms of the timing, well, that's an issue for the Prime Minister and for the NSC to announce in due course. But, well, again, we're not sort of bound by any particular timeline, but only by what is in our national interest. And there are questions that arise and answers that that we've sought. So we'll go through that process and then we can make an announcement in due course.
What role do you expect national security issues to play in the election? Obviously, they're not front and centre. The election's more centred on COVID and the economy. But do you think national security is an important issue?
I think it's a crucial issue, and I think it's a crucial issue over the next 3 to 6 years. I think the situation with the Chinese government is concerning many Australians. I think the situation in the Ukraine is concerning many Australians, because on the issue of national security, you need to think beyond, you know, just the obvious of what could happen in the Ukraine if Russia went in. But the economic consequences need to be considered as well. The spike in energy prices, an oil crisis, what happens with gas reserves. There are many components to national security, and I think that's why national security will feature in this election ahead of many others. I mean, Anthony Albanese is trying to make himself into a small target at the moment, but he's had many concerning points of view in relation to national security that would raise reasonable questions by the Australian voting public. That's very obvious. And he doesn't want to talk about national security because he knows it's an obvious weakness for he and the Labor Party. But it is an important, crucial issue, particularly over the next few years. Australia's preparedness, our ability to defend ourselves if there was to be a conflict in our region, these are all important issues. I think that the public will be asking themselves about who is best able to manage the national security, border security of our country. And I think Scott Morrison has significant runs on the board, and it's a topic that Anthony Albanese doesn't want to talk about for obvious reasons.
Well, the other day, various ministers were getting stuck into Anthony Albanese over China. But what are you actually saying the difference is between the two sides on China. I would have thought, for example, his comments at the National Press Club the other day were pretty bipartisan.
I would always say, don't look at the comments made by an opposition leader on the eve of an election. Look at what they did when they were in government.
What did they do on China that was bad? Remembering it was a different period.
Well, I think if you look at the comments even most recently of Penny Wong, I think they would cause concern. I think if you look at let's deal with the reality of their time in government. Anthony Albanese served under Kim Beazley, Kevin Rudd, Mark Latham, Julia Gillard, Kevin Rudd again. They're the leaders of his party who knew him best. They each decided that Anthony Albanese wasn't suitable to be an economic minister in an economic portfolio or to be in a national security portfolio. It wasn't just one leader. It wasn't just a falling out that he had with Julia Gillard or Kevin Rudd. These people who knew him best took a decision that he was not suitable to go over the whole period that he was in Parliament on the front bench, in opposition and in government. He has never occupied an economic portfolio or a national security portfolio. I think that speaks volumes about his disinterest in the area and, frankly, his lack of experience. In contrast that to Scott Morrison, who served in a number of portfolios and, of course, now in the National Security Committee for a number of years, he has, I think, a position in the public get this. I mean, people in the Labor Party sometimes think the public's stupid. They're not. They get it, and they understand on the issue of national security. Scott Morrison and the coalition, frankly, streets ahead of where Anthony Albanese and the Labor Party is.
But in precise terms, what are you saying that an Albanese government would do on China that is substantially different to what the present government's doing?
I think, Michelle, if you look at their rhetoric in opposition, it's always to support defence. It's always to be strong on national security. What did they do when they got into government last time? They cut defence spending. So they cut research projects. They cut back the number of personnel that we had for planning in relation to conflict within the Indo-Pacific. They cut back on the amount of money that we were able to provide for maintenance and acquisition. That's what they did in government. Of course, in the run-up to 2007, and the run-up to 2010 and 13 and 16 and 19, each of the Labor leaders, pronounced their support of the Australian Defence Force, Australian Border Force, Australian Federal Police, ASIO. When they got into government, they cut the money from those portfolios. That's the reality. So I think they talk a big game in opposition because they don't want to fight on the grounds of national security. And Anthony Albanese is reading from that playbook at the moment. But when they get into government, ultimately they go weak at the knee, and that's been the experience of Labor, successive administrations in the past. And Anthony Albanese, who has been leader of the left for a long time in the Labor Party, has notoriously been weak on national security matters, including border security.
We now have the AUKUS agreement under which we're to acquire nuclear-powered subs, but given the time frame of a couple of decades before we would get those subs, can we really be confident this project will definitely go ahead? And in the meantime, are you going to acquire any more conventional submarines or lease a nuclear submarine?
Well, firstly, the program definitely goes ahead. The idea of the discovery phase now between the US and the UK and Australia is to make a decision as to which platform, either the US or the UK, that we will proceed with. And that's in the statements from the leaders, and that's the nature of the conversation and the negotiations as they continue this very day. We're not looking at acquiring more conventional submarines or, diesel-powered electric submarines. We're not looking at creating a Collins Type 2 or New Age diesel-electric submarine. But we are in a discussion, as I say, with the UK and the US about different options. I can assure you the 20-year timeline is a nonsense. I believe that we will be able to acquire well before that, and I'll have more to say on that in due course once the discussions continue. But they have been very productive, very fruitful, very encouraging, no roadblocks, everything on the table with the US and the UK at the moment. And we will achieve capability well ahead of what the critics are pointing out at the moment. But I'll have more to say about that toward the end of this process.
So you're saying that the building of these submarines will be faster than the 20 years? Could it be 15, say?
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that it will be faster. And I've been driving the process, receiving weekly updates, engaging with our counterparts, and this has momentum. It has buy-in from the US and the UK. It has an urgency because of the way in which the Chinese government is positioning in the Indo-Pacific. The Americans understand what's happening in the Indo-Pacific. The Prime Minister and I have been very deliberate in our language about this being similar to the 1930s. And it's why we do need to speak with a united voice. It's why we need capability. It's why we need deterrence so that we can have peace and stability prevail in our region. We're not going to have peace and stability in the Indo-Pacific into the next decade and beyond that if we sit back with our ears and our eyes, blind to the reality of what is happening. So the need to achieve that capability is obvious to all of our partners, and that's why we're working very closely together for Australia to be able to increase our capability and to provide that additional deterrence so that we can keep peace and stability in our region.
So would it be substantially faster than the original timetable? And what about the short-term lease?
Well, I know you're a patient person, Michelle. This process is about 6 months in. And we've got up to 12 months. I hope that I can condense it a little, but I'll have more to say when that continues. But just out of respect to our partners at the moment, the only point that I would make is that all options are on the table and we have very willing engagement. The US and the UK are family to Australia and we're working very closely with them to achieve that capability for Australia and for a trusted partner of the US and the UK.
And also those options include separately to the build some short-term lease, perhaps?
Well, there's not just the... importantly, I know there's sort of an obvious attraction just to the submarine component of AUKUS, but there's a lot of work that's going on in the area of hypersonics, of long-range missiles, of underwater capability, of our work in space, quantum, AI, there are many elements to the AUKUS agreement, and all of those discussions continue, not just in relation to the submarine and that underwater strike capability and the collection capability of of that sort of boat, but there are many other elements to the discussion, and all I can say is that it's all very productive, and I think it's going to be very fruitful, and it's necessary, absolutely necessary in our nation's interests, both short and long term, to get this right. And that's why we're determined to keep going.
Apart from the marine rotations, would you like to see more American combat capability based in Australia, naval and air assets?
Yes, I'd be very open to it. We'd be very, very happy to have that discussion with the US if they saw strategic advantage in doing so. Already out of AUKUS, as Secretary Austin has made clear, every Air Force airframe will cycle through Australia, so there will be a fantastic benefit militarily and strategically for us out of that. But there's also a very significant economic benefit. The capacity that we will need within defence industry to provide sustainment, refurbishment, repair, upgrades to some of that equipment, I don't think should be lost on anyone. We have a maturing industry. It's with significant capability already, but we will have the significant visiting of, all sorts of asset classes across Air Force, Navy and Army. And if that is accompanied by or there's a subsequent decision to base further numbers there, we'd be very happy to have that discussion with the US or with the UK for that matter. And don't forget to, you know, the Japanese see this time as worrying for them as well. Their experience in the East China Sea, where the PLA Navy dressed up in Coast Guard uniforms in the East China Sea, hundreds of vessels China is operating there at the moment, bumping up against Coast Guard vessels from Japan, all of that provocative behaviour that's happening there at the moment. The Japanese are very keen to engage, as two of the Indians, as we know, through the Quad process. So it's not just about our traditional partners, but many more that we'll continue to engage in. And I think we'll see visits and training exercises, joint training exercises, exchange of that intelligence and information with a number of partners. And Japan and India are as important as any.
There's a report today that the new frigates, costing some $45 billion, will have serious design flaws. What are you doing about this?
Well, there are obvious concerns that we have. This is a contract that was entered into before my time in June of 2018. Many of the problems in these lower-level reports are identified and remediated. And the advice that I've received from the Secretary of my department, from the head of CASG, as well as the Chief of Navy, is that these issues can be identified and rectified. And that's exactly the process that they're going through. I just don't think people should underestimate the complexity in the building of one of these frigates, or the building of a submarine, or the building of an OPV. The technical aspects to it, the warfighting systems, there are literally millions of decision points and componentry pieces that can, go incredibly well or terribly wrong. And that's the nature of the business that we're in. There's a high level of risk in any of these builds, and where problems are brought to our attention, we need to be able to address them, and that's exactly what the department is doing.
Defence has long been criticised for its poor project delivery, with cost overruns, with timing blowouts, with lack of accountability. What have you done to try and rectify this, get a more efficient outfit so taxpayers get more value for their dollars?
Well, we've cancelled significant contracts, not least of which was with the Naval Group. I cancelled a contract recently in relation to helicopters, and we have sent a very clear message to our partners and to the department that failure is not acceptable. Now, I say that with this caveat to the point I just made. We have a very significant acquisition undertaking because we've invested a significant amount of money into defence. We've ramped up from Labor's cost cutting, their cancellation of projects. They never commissioned a ship. Of course, they didn't have these problems because they didn't build anything. So we are building and we are purchasing, and that comes with risk. And I'll mitigate that risk as best I can, and there will be consequence for failure. I've made that clear, as I say, to the department and to our contract partners. But it's not a business without risk. And the problem with the headlines, as we're seeing today, is that it overshadows the 90% of good and the capability that's delivered on time, on budget, provides the underpinning of the warfighting effort that the Australian Defence Force can bring to the table. We have, I think, the most impressive leadership group. We have the most incredible people within the Australian Defence Force. And, I'm able to celebrate that every day, and we can deal with the occasional headline and negative story that's out there. So we need to put it into perspective, accept that there will be, difficulties from time to time, but we'll mitigate that wherever we can.
You've been Minister for Defence now for almost a year. What's been your hardest challenge? What is your hardest challenge you face in overseeing this very complicated portfolio?
The hardest challenge is putting people into harm's way. So decisions that we had to put our troops on the ground in Kabul, for example, was a difficult decision. We ended up bringing out 4,100 people. I had a similar decision when we brought out Yazidi women who were being slaughtered by ISIL, and we had a decision to make to send DFAT and Home Affairs and defence personnel in to bring those people out. and they've now made the most remarkable Australians. And so when we have intelligence, as we did in Kabul, which indicated that there would be explosions, that there would be attempts to break the wall of the airport, and, you know, I knew that we were making decisions where our people would be put in harm's way, that weighs heavily, no question. And every day we've got people out on training exercises, we've got people on covert missions, people who are involved in activities with our partners around the world. So that I think is the most significant weight that you carry as Defence Minister, but making sure that in this time that we make decisions now that can prevent war, which in the judgment of some is inevitable within the Indo-Pacific, I take that responsibility very seriously. And sitting back and trying to bequeath my problems onto my successor is not the way in which I intend to conduct myself as the Minister for Defence. I want to make the decisions that are necessary and that are right and appropriate for the circumstances that we find ourselves in. You can only ever play the hand that you're dealt, and that's what I intend to do. So it's been an eventful 12 months. It's been a great honour. I've served in a number of portfolios, but to serve as Defence Minister and to provide leadership to the men and women of the Australian Defence Force is a particular honour that I cherish every day, and these jobs are always time limited, so I intend to make the most of it for the time that I'm in the portfolio. It's a great honour.
But you would expect to continue in the portfolio if the government's re-elected?
Well, that's a decision for the Prime Minister, and that would certainly be...
You'd want to continue?
I would very much want to continue.
Right.
As Minister for Defence, and but ultimately that's a decision for the PM.
Let's end with a domestic question. The coalition is at a high point in terms of seats in your state of Queensland. Is this election going to be more difficult in that state than the previous one was?
It's more difficult, I think, Michelle, because of the third party involvement. So it's not just Get Up and the unions on the left who have been a particular feature in marginal seat campaigns in Queensland, including my own in recent elections. Most of it counterproductive in the end, but they end up doing, you know, more favours for you than harm. But also, obviously, because of, you know, Palmer, Hanson, you know, and others on the right, the discussion about vaccines, mandates, etc., all of that makes for a complicated mix, particularly in seats where, you know, they'll be decided on 50 or 100 votes when 90, 95,000 people are voting. So I think it's difficult, but I've spent a lot of time on the ground in Queensland over the course of the last couple of months. I've got to say, I don't think anybody is enthused by Anthony Albanese. There are different points where people are disappointed by the government decisions that we've made, but by and large, I think most people accept that through an unprecedented period through COVID over the course of the last couple of years, our country has done probably better than most others on any objective analysis. And I think in the end, people will want to know who's going to keep this country safe, who's going to make sure that the right economic decisions can be made as we come out of COVID. And I think Queenslanders have that at the forefront of their minds. And I think we can hold our position in Queensland and contribute to a coalition victory in May or whenever that is this year.
Peter Dutton, thank you for talking with us today. And that's all from this Conversation Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Ellen Duffy. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.